Welcome to the Power of the Purse podcast, the only show connecting baby boomer women with professional peers. Advice you can use to be more confident in your financial future. Inspiration to take control of your personal finances. With Lynn S. Evans, Certified Financial Planner.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Lynn S. Evans, and I am the host of Power of the Purse podcast. There was a time in my life not too long ago when I believed three things about money. One, women are not supposed to talk about or be included in any conversations about money. Two, women don't have the natural ability to understand anything about money. And three, men know best how to manage money. And those truths I made up about money guided me for years until I realized money was not a foreign language or some other obscure academic exercise, and it was something I could not only understand, but teach to other women. Too many times I've heard stories from women who ought to know better but didn't until they were forced to because of divorce, widowhood, job loss, or the approach of retirement. This podcast will add another chapter to an ongoing informative conversation about financial topics women should be more knowledgeable about. My mission is to help women reduce their financial illiteracy and develop a healthy relationship with money. To that end, my guest today is Anna Rapoport. Anna Rapoport is a consultant, speaker, and author on strategies for a secure retirement and aging workforce issues. She's been a member of the National Academy of Social Insurance since 1993. She retired from Mercer Human Resources Consulting, where she was a worldwide partner, and she's been with Mercer for 28 years. Since 2005, she started Anna Rapoport Consulting and has been going at it full steam. Anna, welcome.
Thank you.
Can't wait to get into a lot of these questions I have, knowing that much of what you're talking about is absolutely my sweet spot as far as the kind of women I'd love to reach and talk to. So let me start by asking a couple of questions that I was intrigued about when I read in your bios and all the awards that you've received over the years. I questioned something when you said, I think I know what you mean by this, but I just want to understand that you mentioned the fact that retirement isn't just about the money. It's vital to have the finances in order, but there's also another side to planning that you call the life portfolio. What is the life portfolio?
Well, Lynn, I think about retirement planning as being really in two main pieces. One about money and the other about how we're going to organize and what we're going to do with our life. Now, you need to get the money in order to be able to do the other part. And I'm assuming you've gotten the money in order and you're doing well with it. Well, then there are the questions like, what am I going to do with my time all day? How am I going to spend my life? What's going to make me feel happy about what I'm doing, and so forth. So When I think about the life portfolio, I think about now four pieces. I think about health. I think about the people that we're going to interact with, pursuits and passions we're going to have. And then I think about places. And I could go over each of those.
Go ahead.
Okay, well, let's start with pursuits. My personal thing is that it's really, really important for you to have something that you're passionate about and that whatever activity it is that you're doing, that you're going to be able at the end of the year or the end of whatever period you count to say, I had a successful year because I did something that I feel good about. And pursuits mean many different things to different people. I'm an actuary. I've been a fellow of the Society of Actuaries for 55 years. So my idea about what makes me happy might not be the same as somebody else. But some of the kinds of things we might think about in pursuits are work, volunteering, and hobbies. community activities, caregiving, and they overlap with the other quadrants as well, travel, and other things that provide us with life satisfaction. For some people, you might get your life satisfaction because you spent time taking care of your grandchildren. But that's not my experience with professional women. I've talked to an awful lot of different people about this and know what a number of them have told me is important to them.
Like what?
Well, first of all, most of the professional women that I've spoken with, they want to do something that's on the more or less serious side for a while after they leave full-time employment. They think about doing something that's important for them. Some of the things I've heard from them is most want a purposeful activity at least for a few years after full-time work. Mm-hmm. Some seek board roles, and particularly for public companies, for people that want to do that, there's a whole lot of specific things you need to know, and that's not my expertise, getting people on boards. Some will need continued income, but for others, this is not a key driver at all. I also found that there's certain professions that where the people typically work to high ages, for example, judges and members of Congress, small business owners, we're not surprised when they're working at 75 or 80, whereas people in corporate life, they don't expect that at all. They expect people to leave often early 60s. Some people want to leave their traditional roles, so don't do anything linked to what they did before, and build an independent new role, maybe consulting in their field, maybe in a new role. Some will move on to jobs at not-for-profits, and mostly some will do volunteering. Others will do some paid work for not-for-profits.
Yeah.
Some have serious interest in music, art, or other creative activity. Some are heavily involved with family or prefer leisure activities only. And some have family caregiving activities that limit their ability to work. So that's kind of a summary of what my conversations with professional women over the last 8 to 10 years, some of the things I've heard from them.
That's really interesting. And I say that because it's not just because it's an interesting concept, because I have known many women, baby boomer women, who have been professionals. And I think you are absolutely right that there is a significant difference between women who have been in corporate America and even in those that own their own professional practices, attorneys, dentists, physicians, depending on who they are and what type of work they've done, they don't see that there is an arbitrary age by which they must retire. But the corporate America type thing, you're right, they want them out by their 60s. But I've just seen recently, I mean, as close as last week, where there's been some discussion because our current economy is so understaffed in the sense of there aren't any people to draw from for whatever corporations need. They are now going back to the over 50s and over 60s applicants because they need people to come in and do this. And so many baby boomers have just never quite gotten around to saving the money they needed. And so it's a good mix. It happens, it does well for both sides of that. But assuming that you were someone who, as you said, was self-employed, which is a really big distinction, self-employed and in the professions, a lot of those people have no interest in retiring because they love what they do.
Right. I think what many of those people do is they don't have any interest in retiring, but they may have an interest in redefining their work schedules and their workload and getting a different balance. So some of them might bring in a partner, or sometimes small business people have a child or a family member that comes in and helps them and will eventually take over. But they're often interested, I think, in having more free time, being able to balance their life differently, but not to become disengaged.
Yeah, and that's a good word.
I think it's also really important for people to recognize that people want to do something based on what they feel inside is important, so that they feel like they are adding value and doing something worthwhile. I had a conversation with a judge one day, and she said, oh, well, I'm going to run next time, but I won't run the time after that because I'm going to be after age 80. And I thought that was so typical in terms of about the age that I see that people are really, okay, it's time to be doing a lot less. When you get up to that age, it's very few people that are still
true
committed professionally.
But now you mentioned something, and you include yourself in this, as a phased retiree. What does that mean?
Well, to me, being a phased retiree means that in the path from being full-time committed to work in a regular job and being 100% out of the labor force or out of purposeful work, you're doing it in steps so that you still have some professional commitment, which might be earning, it might be paid, or it might even be volunteering. You have some professional commitment, but you're gradually changing it over time. For me, it's meant that I've continued to be very active with the actuarial profession, and I volunteer for the Society of Actuaries. I serve as chair of the Committee on Post-Retirement Needs and Risks. I'm a past president. I was president about 20 years ago. I serve as chair of the steering committee for the new aging and retirement effort. So I do a lot of work. I've also done a little bit of paid research for them, and I've done some consulting for other clients. But I'm very involved in trying to think about these retirement issues, and particularly issues relating to women and longer work. And I try to have influence, and I'm really trying to influence the system and make the world be better, because there's so many issues that get overlooked.
Yeah. Let's talk about that one in particular, because that's something that I'm really intrigued by. And that is the amount of poverty in women who are retired and widowed. So let's talk about that for a minute. What is it that you see that is so different about that situation that maybe could have been avoided? I don't know if that's the case. But with all the statistics that you've garnered on that subject, have you come to any conclusions about what we need to be doing as a society differently than what we're doing now for that to stop?
That's a very interesting question. And in the work we've done at the Society of Actuaries, I think I can point out several things. And of course, as you pointed out, Lynn, the poverty rates for women who are alone are much lower than for married couples. Mm-hmm. One of the things that in the research we've done, the Society of Actuaries research, we've done focus groups or in-depth interviews of people who were within 10 years of retirement, after retirement, more than 15 years retired, and then we have worked on people over age 85. We've done surveys about people's attitudes and what they're doing to retirement plan now for 20 years, every second year. So we have a lot of research. Mm-hmm. Planning horizons are often too short. That's, first of all, a big problem.
Agreed. Yeah.
A second thing that I would say, which is a big issue, is that as our society overall has shifted from defined benefit plans away from them to defined contribution plans, some people have worked long time in companies where they had good defined contribution plans, and they still have good company provided benefits. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of people, there are many fewer people that have substantial company provided benefits. The second thing that we found from our research is that people don't consider, when they do plan, an awful lot of people, and these would be people that probably don't have professional planners, a lot of them, these would be average people, they don't really think about unexpected events. They're much more focused on cash flow. And we've heard several times, well, you know, I figured out how much my regular monthly bills are, and I have enough money coming in, so I guess I'm okay.
Yeah.
And that really caused us, the first time we heard it, to step back and say, whoa. That's really an issue. But there's a lot of that. Now, at the same time, those people, to the extent they have assets, they don't want to spend their assets down. They want to hold on to them to use for emergencies. But many of them haven't. Long-term care is also a major challenge. Our research has showed, and that was a topic of emphasis for us in our 2017 risk survey, both caregiving and long-term care, that while people are very aware that it's an issue, very few people are doing anything to plan for it. And for women, this can be a particularly difficult thing. And this goes beyond the Society of Actuaries research, because the woman who may have a great job and think, and then a caregiving issue comes along, her spouse, her parent, somebody else really needs help, and she decides to leave her job or to cut way back. Although a lot of those people end up making a lot less money over their career, and they've taken care of other people. And while they've taken care of other people, then they find that they're left with not very much at all. Also, when there's a long period of illness, it often may leave the survivor, who would be the woman, with much less. One study that was done some years ago found that the people who were doing caregiving over a period of time had $300,000 less assets for retirement than if they hadn't done the caregiving. That's a lot of money.
It is.
I would also say that particularly as we shifted from defined benefits to defined contribution plans, one of the things that happened is that there were pretty good disability provisions for long-term disability built into many of those defined benefit plans.
Yeah.
That's not true at all for the defined contribution plans.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're talking about, when thinking about widows, if you're talking about an individual who got disabled themselves earlier on, or somebody that was married to someone that got disabled earlier on, that disability may have wiped out whatever savings they had, and then that's going to leave the widow in poverty as well.
Yes.
And just planning for widowhood is one of the things that, for the people that are planning short-term cash flows, it's just one of the big risks they're not planning for. So there are a variety of different things that contribute to women being relatively less well off. Can I come back for a minute to just go quickly to mention what the other quadrants of the life portfolio are?
Oh, sure. Go ahead.
Well, if we come back to the life portfolio, I talked about pursuits and some of the experiences with pursuits. Now, the next quadrant I'm going to talk about is people. And there's quite a bit of research that has shown that social engagement is important to having a decent life in retirement and having success in retirement. And that means primarily being connected to other people. I mean, you might be connected to them because you're your next door neighbor. They might be your family. You might go to exercise class with them. They might live in your community. I mean, it doesn't mean you have to go out to parties, but the who and some of the things to think about in connection with people would be, who are the family that are nearby, the friends? What about community organizations? What can I do to maintain and make new contacts? And I just talk a little bit about myself here. I'm 78, and one of the things that I did in Chicago is that I wanted to make some more retiree contacts, because an awful lot of my contacts are in the business community. Well, the neighborhood that I live in has what we call a village, and villages are a form of organization for older people. And I believe they'd be mostly in larger cities, but they're kind of like a retirement village without walls. They provide a way for the people within a given neighborhood to connect to each other. And that gave me a way to get connected to some more older people in my neighborhood. And while I haven't really had to rely on them yet, I for me, it's knowing too, that's another support system that's there if I need them. I've made some connections there. We also have a home in a gated community in the South, and that there are a lot of activities there, and I think that's quite common in gated communities.
Yeah.
So that's a way to make connections, have friends, and have people that will help you. And my observation in that community is that there's an awful lot of people helping each other. So I think that the helping each other would also say you shouldn't be afraid, if you can afford it, to use help if you need it and to outsource specific tasks. But one of the good things about having these connections is a lot of times the best way to find the way to outsource is to ask that friend.
Yes.
So that's the people side. So should we go on to places now?
Yeah, sure.
Well, the largest item of expense overall for retirees in America, for the older people, is housing.
Yes.
Housing is also extremely important because people have a sense of their whole person is in their house. They have their things there. They care a lot about what their home is. Where you live defines what medical system you have access to, what doctors, what hospitals. Depending on where you are, you may have very different options for transportation. You may have very different activities. There's huge differences in the cost of housing between different communities as well. And if you have a financial issue and you need to cut expenses, and the Society of Actuaries research really shows that retirees overall are very good at managing and cutting expenses, moving to a less expensive place might be a definitely way to do that, including a less expensive area. If I think about Chicago or moving 200 miles away to some of the smaller communities in the Midwest, the same house might cost 3 or 4 times as much in Chicago. That's
wow.
I know that's unbelievable.
It is.
But I think when you go to any of the high-cost areas in the country, you'll find places where you can find housing for a lot less money. There's also a concept in terms of places to live. I mentioned the villages, such as called age-friendly communities. The World Health Organization has defined what's an age-friendly community, and some communities are making efforts to make it very good for older people to live. Some are not. So giving careful thought to where you want to live and what the issues are, I think that's a really important thing. And the big thing is you have a choice. And for a lot of people, it's really important to be near family. It depends a lot on the situation, but that's something I believe people should make a conscious choice and not just assume, well, I've been here for 20 years.
Yeah.
I'm going to stay here. My last quadrant that I just want to mention, I'm not going to really talk about any detail, is it's really important to maintain health. And if you have problems, then you connected to health or the support system you need.
Absolutely. All important. The four, that's really good. I've heard people say 7, 10. Many of these are integrated anyway, but I think those are the four biggies. And thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, and I think the basic idea that you have on the one side, you have your money, but on the other side, you've got your life to think about. And just having money doesn't make it. I'd like to throw in another idea that I've shared with many people. Some people think about retirement as it's a really long vacation. Well,
I don't think so.
Well, but people think that way.
I know.
And I want to point out that from my perspective, and I've told this to people, and then they suddenly go, oh, yeah, vacation is a break from what you normally do.
Mm-hmm.
The minute you start doing something all of the time so that it's not a break anymore, that it's what you do all of the time, after a while, it's not vacation anymore. It's now you need a break from it.
Yeah.
And it loses its charm. And people that have tried, for example, to play golf every day, it might take few months, it might take a year before they're like, oh, well, I don't really think I want to do this anymore.
Yeah, it kind of wears thin.
It does.
And I think exactly what you said, I wrote a book called Power of the Purse. And much of it is about, there's a lot focusing on retirement and especially what you call the life portfolio. I don't think I use those terms, but I think it's significant that people have to really look at what do you do with this time in your life. But one of the things I said, it's just exactly what you said, that after a while, if your life is all about leisure, and maybe it takes 6 months, a year, 2 years, or even 3 years, at some point you realize that that's your job. that becomes your job, to go out on the golf course or do whatever. So then you need, like you said, you need a break. So what do you do with that time? I think it's really important that people maybe get that out of their systems for maybe 6 months to a year. They play, you know, and then after a while the play becomes boring and then they're saying, okay, what's next? And that's where I think you're right, that you have to have more than just a passing thought.
But I would say about the playing part, and thinking about myself, I'm still very active in the actuarial profession.
Yeah.
But at the same time, if there is something happening on Wednesday that I would really like to do, unless I have a specific commitment on Wednesday, I don't need to say, well, I work on Wednesday. I can say, it's fine. I can go to the museum on Wednesday, and I can do my work on Thursday or Saturday.
Exactly. Exactly. You have the freedom to move your hours around. And I've just, last week I had an opportunity to go into Manhattan to see a play. It was, of course, on a Wednesday. And I did the same thing. I said, you know what? The play's on Wednesday afternoon. Whatever I was going to do, I'll do it on Thursday. So it's just having the freedom to make those choices, but to still stay involved and stay connected, I think is the key.
And I think it's really important for people to have something that they feel is valuable. Another thing that I've noticed with a lot of people who are older, mm-hmm. and that's something that there's probably a need for in many places. First of all, many of them get very connected to family, and the 85 and over research showed that family frequently help people when they need help at older ages, more like doing things rather than contributing money, driving them someplace, helping them in the house. Maybe they move in together. But there are an awful lot of people that help neighbors and help other people and spend quite a bit of time helping other people. And that can be a definitely a purposeful activity. And that can be an activity that you do strictly as a friendship thing, but it also can be an activity that you decide you're going to do as having a little concierge service or a little bit of something to help people, and people can make a little bit of money that way.
Exactly. That's a nice way to put it, a little side hustle. So let me switch this around now, because I'm really curious about a woman who's been an actuary for a very long time. Somewhere along the line, you developed a relationship with money that started, like for most of us, when we were kids. So what is your first memory around money?
Well, I'm 78 now. My first memories, which I really don't want to say much about, but in my first marriage, were that I didn't have enough control. Mm-hmm. And I would say that there are probably a lot of people that could tell that story.
I think, yep.
I would say a later memory that I would like to share is that in my second marriage, I think we have a really good partnership. And one of the things that we did that turned out to be enormously useful was that we did very good long-term projections. Mm-hmm. And year-by-year projections, and we would see how they worked out, and we tracked assets and tracked our savings, and we were strong savers. So we lived very modestly for a long time, and that meant we had some money to save, and that's really paid off.
And what lessons about money did you learn when you were growing up?
Well, the lessons about money I learned when I was growing up were, my parents were refugees from Nazi Germany. Mm-hmm. And they didn't have very much money, even though my father had been trained to be a judge in Germany, but because of the evolution of the politics, he wasn't able to do it. And then he became a social worker in the United States. But they worked very hard to save money. And I think I grew up very focused on saving and being afraid, just being really afraid to spend money, which is probably different from most children, certainly today.
Yeah.
Those projections that we did and seeing how the savings were growing, that was really important for me to learn to say, well, yes, you know, we save money and here's what happens from it.
So did that give you some freedom then to spend money?
It did. I mean, it pretty much did. One of the tests, though, that I've applied for a number of years and told other people to apply is when we were going to do something, is to ask the question, well, how will it make my life better? Mm-hmm. And over the years, people have said to me about my home, for example, oh, well, you could redo this and it would be really nicer, and you could redo this and it would be really nicer. And we have made some improvements, but overall, when you ask the question, okay, now how will it make my life better? Most of the time, the answer is, thank you for your suggestion. But I remember a conversation I had with a professional woman. She was a doctor and very successful. And she was thinking, she had a beautiful home, but she was thinking of maybe moving to a much bigger, nicer place still. And we talked about the issue of how would it make your life better. And then we talked about the issue of, well, maybe she would want to make life choices in a few years where she would make less money. And if she saved money and if she didn't spend so much more money on housing, she'd have very different life choices than if she'd gone ahead and spent the more money. And she decided not to spend the more money. But that was, and that was strictly as a friend. I'm not an advisor to individuals. But it's this, how will it make your life better, I think, is a really...
That's a good question.
It's a really good question. Because I think, especially as Americans, we buy so much stuff. I would also share an observation. I know a lot of older people, and almost all of us have more stuff than we want.
Yes, indeed.
But the issues around acquiring stuff, I think as Americans, we just acquire too much stuff. And we need a way to ask ourselves earlier, do I really need all that stuff?
Mm-hmm. That's true. Most of us can say, no, we don't, but too late.
And it complicates our lives because we have to keep it and take care of it.
And what are the events that have happened in your life that you would describe as defining moments?
Well, I would say several things. Certainly the fact that I managed to go to the University of Chicago and major in math, that got me in a direction where I could study for the actuarial exams and become an actuary. Becoming an actuary was a tremendously defining moment for me.
Yeah.
And it opened the way to a variety of different opportunities.
Anna, when you were at that age where you got that, how many women were there in your class and those who had math as a major?
Oh, very few.
I would think, yeah.
There were very few women actuaries. I was not the first woman to be president of the Society of Actuaries, but I was in many, many meetings over many years where I was the only woman in the room, mm-hmm. or where I was by far the most senior woman. And I was, for a long time, I was the youngest, and now I'm usually the oldest, so, you know, changed. But that was the first defining moment. I think I worked in the life insurance industry from 1958 to 1976, and I had three jobs. First job was in a larger life insurance company where it was sort of a traditional. The second job was in a very small life insurance company where there were two credentialed actuaries there, and we had to do almost everything. We had five people in the actuarial department, and compared to a large company might have 100 or 200 or 300, but we had to do everything, and we had to talk to the sales force. We had to work on all the different things. And I learned so much about how all the pieces fit together. And I would say generally, being in a smaller organization where you have to see how everything fits together versus being very specialized in a large organization, you learn a lot. Of course, that smaller organization probably doesn't have as good benefits and other mm-hmm. things. But that was really defining for me. Then I got a job at the Equitable in New York, which was really, because of, I think, that small company experience, focused on thinking about the future and how the financial services industry. Was there for 3 years. And that was a tremendous job because it enabled me to take what I had learned, but also to think about the future and to do a lot of work where I was thinking forward. Too often we have work where we, instead of thinking forward, we're thinking about what is the problem that I have to solve today, not what's going to happen tomorrow or the next day, let alone 5 years, 10 years, 20 years out. And then I decided that I was going to switch. Life insurance companies, I thought, were not a place where there was going to be a great deal of more senior opportunity for women at that time. Yeah. And I was ready for something else. So I switched to the pension consulting arena and joined Mercer in 1976, which it just happened that that was when the pension law had changed and there was a lot of opportunity for people to enter the pension field, but they were willing to recognize my diverse opportunity. Well, I had a life-defining moment for me there was that in 78, 2 years after I switched, and I had in those 3 years when I had been doing that research on what on demography and on social change and a variety of things, I really had learned a lot about what was happening in the country. In 78, there were three sets of new regulations that kind of drove people crazy. Well, I was able to think with Mercer, okay, let's look at demography, how it's changing, how the systems we're working on are changing, and then how these laws apply. And I helped them organize a series of seminars that were given at 10 cities in the country, and I keynoted them. Well, that really got me a lot of recognition in the company. Mm-hmm. I was already an officer of the Society of Actuaries then, so I was nationally known there as serving on their executive committee. So that got me a lot of visibility in the firm, and it got me really focused in thinking about bigger picture, longer term things, rather than a sort of narrow or technical role. So I'd say those would be a few of the things. Certainly getting elected president of the Society of Actuaries was a huge thing for me.
That was a biggie. Yep.
That was a biggie. And I really got interested in women's issues, specifically, I'd say around age 50. And I have been ever since.
Yay. Really, that's, I think more of us need to come up with the science behind the thoughts we believe about what's going on in our society. Yes. And the more that you can prove exactly what we're talking about, I think the more people are going to have to stop and really pay attention to what's going on.
And I'd like to just take the other side of this life-defining events thing and tell you about two awards I've won in the last couple of years. The Plan Sponsor Council of America, which are primarily is an organization of people in companies that manage benefit plans, they gave me a Lifetime Achievement Award 2 years ago. And this year, the Employee Benefit Research Institute gave me their Lily White Award, which is also a sort of an award of achievement in employee benefits over many years. And to me, this was recognition that this work that we've been doing in the Society of Actuaries and the work that I've been doing, it's getting recognized outside of the profession and the broader world. And that made me so pleased. I am so happy that this 15 years since I left Mercer, that I really have continued with this. Because at one time I thought, oh, well, I'll retire from there and I'll just go and do my artwork because I'm also a painter.
Uh-huh.
But I'm very pleased that I've continued with this and I've been able to balance things.
Good. And there was something else you said under the things that you do for fun. I don't know what that is. What is an urban sketcher?
Well, an urban sketcher, this is a worldwide movement, and it's a great thing. I discovered the movement only a couple of years ago. We're people who go and draw things, and you go out, and it might be to a coffee shop, it might be out on the street, it might be in somebody's house, but you go and you draw something when you're there versus you don't take a picture home and draw it.
Okay.
And also, to be an urban sketch, you normally have some context. So let's say we're in a coffee shop and I'm having coffee with you and I decide to draw a person. Mm-hmm. If I just draw the person, it's not an urban sketch. But if I draw the person and then there's a table next to them and some coffee and a little sign showing it's a coffee shop, that's an urban sketch.
Okay.
Well, I have found that this has been very rewarding. I have loved doing it, and it's brought me together with people. In Chicago now, the urban sketchers have over 1,000 people are affiliated with them, and the movement is less than 10 years old. So
where can we see these sketches that you've done?
I have some on my website. I post some occasionally on Facebook. I'll probably post some more on my website, but maybe I'll have a show again. I have had an art show, but it's been a while.
Oh, that's neat. I love it. I just love the idea of urban sketchers. I think that's pretty cool. Next time I go into a coffee shop, if I see somebody, I'll just have to say to them, excuse me, are you an urban sketcher?
Well, you can do a Google search on urban sketching. You'll get lots of things.
Okay. That's really wonderful. So at that, I have to say we're out of time. So I want to say thanks to my guest, Anna Rappaport. And Anna, tell people how they can get in touch with you if they have any additional questions.
Oh, thank you, Lynn. I think the best way to get in touch with me would be by email. And people can email me at anna.rappaport@gmail.com. That's anna.rappaport@gmail.com. I also have a website, and you can try to send me a message through the website, but it doesn't always work very well.
Yeah, I hate that. But anyway, okay. So to all of you in my Power the Purse community, I hope today's podcast gave you some freedom around money and even the littlest bit of courage to know more. If so, please visit my website, lynnsevans.com, and look around. And while you're there, sign up for my newsletter and a free guide. So thank you very much for listening. And until the next time, remember, money is not the enemy. Your ignorance of it is. Thanks and goodbye.
This has been Power of the Purse with Lynn S. Evans, Certified Financial Planner. For more information and a free copy of The 7 Myths Our Mothers Taught Us About Money, visit online at womenofsubstancellc.com. That's womenofsubstancellc.com. Be sure to subscribe for more inspiring stories and information to help you take charge of your financial future. Thanks for listening.